I'm going to do this by my.
Bend it away.
There we go. Yes. All right. That's all right.
That was good.
Is that in trouble? Disastrous. I'd stretch your face.
Just don't move.
Just don't move or speak. Okay, that's... I'm not going to move. I'm Oliver Bullough. I'm a journalist and I write about corruption and the former Soviet Union. I recently published a book called Moneyland, which grew out of... It's a book about kleptocracy and assorted misdeeds associated with it, which grew out of work I did in Ukraine in 2014, a lot of which was about corruption in healthcare and how corruption in healthcare affects ordinary citizens, where the money goes, where the money should be. And I'm really excited about the panel this evening, because often when we hear about corruption, it's a bit depressing because it's incredibly hard to do anything about it. It's very hard to track the money. It's very hard to stop the theft. But actually, what we're going to be talking about this evening is a really interesting and extraordinary intervention by Crown agents that has made the big difference. Before we start talking about that, I'm hoping Fergus is going to explain in three words what Crown Agents is, because Crown Agents is not nearly as famous as it deserves to be.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for setting that up. So I'm Fergus. I'm Chief Executive of Crown Agents. Many of you may have might have heard of Crown Agents over the years. It's been around since 1833. We're a not-for-profit international development company passionate about transforming the future by our consulting, training, supply chain and procurement expertise. We were part of the government until 1997, when Blair spun us out when he was spinning out lots of different things, and we are now a separate not-for-profit company. But it's that history and that relationships with working with governments over the long term that really helps us in understanding how to get things done on the ground, and Ukraine is one of our best examples of that.
So our guests this evening, we've got next to me here is Henry Marsh, brain surgeon, actually a brain surgeon. Which one of those things, also a sort of star of film and stage, and an author, Do No Harm, and more recently...
Admissions, it's called.
Admissions. Yeah. And also, the first person when I wanted to write about corruption in Ukraine, I actually went to Henry and said, please give me a load of contacts. And essentially, all the stories I've written have been based entirely on those contacts ever since. So I'm very grateful for that. Next to Henry is Tanya Koroshenko, the Crown Agents. What's your official title in Ukraine?
Ukraine.
Boss. Crown Agents. Boss.
Country representative.
Country representative. And then Fergus Drake, the CEO of Crown Agents. So I'm hoping that we're going to start with Henry. What I'd like to try and get a sense of is what corruption looks like in Ukraine, in healthcare in Ukraine.
Well, from the bottom up.
From the perspective of because you've done a lot of work, you've been there and done a lot of operations in Ukraine, you have many friends and colleagues in Ukraine. What it looks like for a doctor, how does it impact on you?
Well, the first thing is that the doctors are all paid a very small salary by the state. I think it's about $200 a month, the recent figures. So that's not a living wage. So the doctors have to be paid by the patients and their families. And that's it's a sort of unregulated, invisible private practice. We have inequality in private practice in this country, but at least it's all transparent. I don't know whether there's an actual sort of market economy in what people charge or not. I don't know. I know that I've been working really with sort of dissenters and refuseniks in the medical system, and are very much persona non grata with the big official professors in Kiev. And they certainly make a lot of money. I'm told, in my own specialty of brain surgery, there's one specialist in Kiev who charges about $5,000 minimum from the family. So, of course, the state provides the bare minimum of oxygen buildings, very limited equipment, and then it's up to the doctors to provide everything else themselves, and they can make as much money or as little money as they wish.
So, I mean, there is theoretically a constitutional right to free healthcare.
Well, there is a constitutional right, yes, absolutely, but it's meaningless because the doctors are paid so little.
I mean, so from a doctor's perspective, it's potentially quite a good situation in that the facilities are provided by the government.
Yes.
And then you get to charge.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, however much.
The problem is that, you know, it's quite clear in America, as the obvious example, that fee-for-service systems are much more expensive than salaried systems. There are some exceptions in America, like the Mayo Clinic and the Cleveland Clinic. But on the whole, if doctors, particularly surgeons, are paid for doing more, they will do more. So you have a sort of double whammy in Ukraine, where you have, and even now, a pretty ignorant medical workforce in terms of evidence base and a more rational approach to medicine, who are, the more operating they do, the more money they make. So when I was just come back from America, from Stanford, where I was lecturing, so I find it very bizarre that Ukraine and America are at the opposite ends of the poles in health expenditure. Both countries where I see more unnecessary, stupid operating than what we certainly do in Northern Europe.
So the one, so one consequence of the system is too many unnecessary procedures.
Yes.
What are the other consequences?
Poor people lose out. So I'm now currently working. I'll be there next week in the children's hospital. When I say working, it's just sort of teaching and supervising things like that, occasionally operating. So I mean, a lot of my friends in Lviv will raise charitable money to help pay for more expensive operations. That's often paying for the equipment. I mean, the last case I was indirectly involved in was a child with spinal curvature. It's not an operation I do, but I was there with some Polish colleagues who were being paid for it. And then there was a sort of, you know, internet, social media crowdfunding campaign to pay for all the expensive metal equipment which was needed to treat the child. So it's a very sort of ad hoc, disorganized system. I know from your Spare Marvellous book, which everybody ought to read, I think it's extraordinarily important.
Or buy it.
I'm looking for the plug. I know there's institutional corruption at a very high level as well, with all the pharmaceutical procurement and things like that. I know one story of an example. The person I worked mainly with, a man called Kurilets, I've now totally fallen out with him. But it's a bit of an animal farm story. I thought I was helping this inspired individual rebel against the dogmatic, dictatorial, monolithic Soviet professors. And after 20 years, he was very successful, but then became a monolithic Soviet professor himself. And the only person he'd teach anything was his own son. Because, of course, Soviet medicine was incredibly nepotistic. The only person you'd train or teach was your own family. But at one point, he, it's about 10 years ago, the drug ketamine, which we don't use in England very much for anaesthesia, although it's becoming rather fashionable as a drug for severe depression, is used a lot for anaesthesia in Soviet, post-Soviet medicine. And more or less overnight, I think a law was passed making it into a controlled drug. And the police turned up in my colleague's clinic and said, you haven't, and said you're being inspected, and you're not keeping the ketamine in a proper controlled drug locked up cupboard. And then he was going to be faced with an enormous fine. So he then had to work out whether he had to bribe the local medical authorities or the boss of the local medical authorities in Kiev. And he worked out it was cheaper to bribe the man in Kiev than the people locally in order not to have to pay the fine for not having. And in the end, it was 24 hours notice in which they came round. So they probably went round lots of hospitals with this new law about ketamine, getting lots of money that way.
So it's essentially a very suboptimal medical system.
It's suboptimal. I mean, the hopeful thing is there are lots of very, it seems to me, lots of very idealistic young doctors at the bottom. One can only hope they won't be kind of corrupted by the financial difficulties they face when they actually become doctors. The other problem, which is as far as I can, is a total lack of proper postgraduate training. The undergraduate training is probably okay. Some of them know English language only, which makes sense, because English is the lingua franca for medicine. But the postgraduate training is chaotic. It's largely a patronage system. I think you have to pay the professor if he's not your father. a large sum of money to be taken on, and there's very little organised teaching as such. And of course, one of the most important things about any medical system is the postgraduate training. And the tradition there still is that the professors are right up there. But as you go further east in Europe, the medical system has become more and more vertical. We're kind of a bit diagonal in England. I mean, very, very different. The professors will not share their surgical secrets with anybody other than their sons, because they're all in competition together. There's all fierce financial competition, and although it's a little bit more civilised than it was, but certainly many years ago my colleague was receiving death threats and all sorts of things. So fiercely competitive, all based on the illegal private practice system.
So in 2013 to 14, Ukraine had a revolution. As you know, one of the key causes of the anger that drove protesters out onto the street was anger about corruption, that this kind of corruption that Henry's talking about, this essentially small group of insiders doing very well out of their positions of power, whether that be a position of power in government or a position of power in medicine or whatever. And so after the president fled in February 2014, there was this great demand and desire for change. There was a new health minister who had been among the protesters and so on. And this is where Tanya comes in. Can you talk about what those demands for change, what they looked like, and how you got involved in that?
Hello, my name is Tanya, and I am a terrible optimist.
A terrible optimist. You mean you're bad at being an optimist?
I'm really bad being optimist, but, you know, since I'm Ukrainian, I know everything that Henry is talking about here. So that's my normal life. This is where I live. But I still believe that good things would happen, and I think that experience of Crown Nations is something to prove that, in fact, changes are happening. So actually, just one comment to you, we are the ones who are delivering control drugs. So Crown Nations is responsible for this program as well. So I just want to talk about slightly different. So Henry was talking about something that touches each and every citizen in Ukraine. I mean, interchanging with your doctor, just meeting your primary care, meeting a doctor. So it's something very, very, I mean, you can feel it, you can touch it. It's, you know, you are putting the money into the pocket of your doctor after each and every reception, etc. So that is something that is visible. I want to talk about a slightly different level, and we call it in Ukraine sophisticated corruption. That is something that is actually in the law, and that is something that was actually allowed, and that was something that was happening basically legally. So that was all in legislation. And now we start talking about procurement. So in fact, procurement is a very straightforward, simple thing. Once you've done it correctly, you will never return back to bad practices. And that's what Crown Nation has been doing for all these hundreds and something years when we are in place. So we were invited by the Ukrainian government back in 2015 to help them to deal with the corruption in the healthcare procurement. So there was a general understanding that the way it was done before, that situation led to terrible consequences, where the hospitals were left basically without the basic stuff. So in Ukraine, the budget is formed in a way that there is a lot of money that are kept at the central level for the procurement and the certain amount of programs. So Crown Agents were invited to deal with some of the programs along with other two organizations. And the first year was really striking even for the Ukrainian staff of Crown Agents working in Kiev. Because when we first calculated our savings, we were shocked. So we didn't do any magic. We just conducted an open, competitive tenders. Very simple things. No invention, nothing. Just announced tender with the competitive qualification criteria, conducted the proper evaluation, and the result that we received was striking. It was 40%.
So just before you get to the result, when you say an open, competitive tender, what you mean is you're saying we will buy...
Yes.
X amount of these drugs, yes. And just someone, you know, makes an offer. How much?
Yes.
How much will,
yes,
the, will you charge? But, which is what the government had been doing for years, right? The government had been supposedly making open tenders for years,
yes.
Right? So what had been going wrong? Why? Because the problem was the drugs were so expensive that there weren't enough of them. So why were they so expensive?
So when we entered the scene, the quantity of suppliers that were used by Minister of Health of Ukraine was around five.
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 Five individuals.
Five. No, well, five companies that were supplying drugs. So the first year we showed 37 suppliers. Now we have 93 plus. So you can imagine that there is a trust working with somebody like Crown Agents. So they are coming to sell to us, not to the government of Ukraine. And the first year, actually, when we announced the tender, so we said that we will be buying on behalf of the Ukrainian government, but there will be our procedures, and we will be dealing with that. So we just showed the difference. We were saying that, guys, this is the standards that we will be using, and there is a zero tolerance to corruption. So that's it. Again, it was very, very simple things. And as I said, the results were really striking, even the first year.
So let's hear about the results. How much money did you save?
So in total, over these years that we've been working for the Ministry of Health of Ukraine, we were managing $150 million US dollars. And the savings, the total savings that we showed was around $50
million. $50 million. So.
And we were buying everything. So we covered everything that they wanted. So we bought everything that they wanted, and we still had it.
So you were buying exactly what they were buying before. The drugs were the same, and you'd save $50 million just like that.
Just like that.
I mean, it seems counterintuitive because you are more people being paid to do work that was already being done, and yet it's much cheaper.
It's much cheaper.
So someone must be losing quite a lot of money because of you.
Trust us, definitely.
Yeah. So did they try and do anything to stop you?
There is one thing that I wanted to stress. When we started working in Ukraine, we never expected such a massive campaign against us.
Campaign against
campaign.
You.
That was really a campaign. This was a very structured campaign against us. The resistance was really huge. But I have to say, we have to mark the role of the civil society organizations that were always supporting us and saying that, you know, you just measure the results. You have to see the results. Oliver, you've been to Ukraine many times, and you know that the changes in Ukraine, they were not top-down. They were bottom-up.
I mean, this is what Henry's talking about young doctors who are dissatisfied with the system.
Not only young doctors.
Young patients, young actors.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
So you had, I mean, you were contracted by the government.
We were contracted by the Ministry of Health.
And so who was trying to stop you doing your work?
So you can't say who was trying to stop you, right? Because we, Crown Agents, is not the, we're not fighting corruption. We're showing the difference. We are providing just professional services. In Ukraine, there is a lot of institutions that are watching after this issue. So definitely we can't say who was. But the massive attacks in the mass media and attempt to discredit our work, that it's always there. But over these 4 years, so it's almost zero. So it's basically everybody understands that the result is there and the result is visible and the result is touchable. So you can see that at the hospital.
Tell me about stents.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, what is a stent? And then tell
well,
me
that's the question.
What is a stent?
A stent is, it's actually named after a doctor called Dr. Stent.
No.
American years ago.
It is.
They're usually sort of very fine metal filigree tubes which you put into partially blocked blood vessels to hold them open, to open them up. And you insert them through an artery, usually through the femoral artery. They're used extensively for carotid artery disease. And Ukraine, I mean, another problem it has is public health is not very good. They smoke an enormous amount of smoking. There's lots of arterial disease, lots of people having strokes and third up carotid arteries.
The national snack is lard.
That's right, national salad.
Salad. Chocolate, yes, lard.
Washed down with lots of vodka. It was very nice.
Okay.
But anyway, they're very expensive. Well, I mean, I didn't know. But in England, they probably cost, well, it depends, but endovascular treatment, I think it's about $15,000 in England, something like that. I'm not quite sure, but there are lots of different varieties, but they are pretty expensive.
So cardiovascular.
Yeah, that's the whole operation.
That's the whole thing, yes. That's with the hardware. Yes.
Okay. So cardiovascular disease, the single biggest cause of death in Ukraine, and there were no stents.
Well, in fact, there were stents, but the prices for that stents were not acceptable for Ukrainian patients. So we started working on the stents program in 2016. And again, the first result that we received was striking, because when we announced the tender, we conducted the tender, we did evaluation, and then in the middle of the night, I got a call from a girl who was just doing the accounting, and she said, you know, we've made savings. I said, okay, what savings? She said, actually, we can buy everything they want, and we will spend only half of the money that they allocated for that.
You buy everything they want for half of the money?
For half of the money. So, and I think that was the first year when the need of the hospitals for the emergency cases stenting were covered by 100%.
100%
coverage.
So all the cases that needed, when someone needed an operation?
State program covers only emergency cases.
Right.
So when you're delivered to the hospital with the acute heart attack.
Yeah.
And you need stenting. This is something that is covered by the central government,
yeah.
But at the same time, there is a procurement done by the local governments as well. So we are working on the emergency cases program.
And do we know how many people survived as a result?
So I don't have these calculations, yeah. But we know that according to the Association of the Doctors, they said that they have a drop of less, so it's 20% less death.
20%.
Well, there's an alternative to open surgery, which was approved in what's called a cross endarterectomy, and is minimally invasive.
Yeah.
And the results of, it's not actually my area of expertise, but I think it's slightly better than, it's more expensive than surgery.
Yeah.
But it's less morbid.
Yeah.
Which is why it's the standard treatment for carotid artery disease in the West.
You say less morbid, you mean?
Well, for the patient.
Few people die.
Yeah, and you don't actually cut open the carotid, cut open the neck,
yeah.
Cut open the carotid.
So, I mean, this is...
As you do.
Yes. I mean, it is, you know, there are many, many health challenges in Ukraine. You know, cardiovascular disease is just one of them. There are many health challenges. And it should be said, it isn't just Crown Agents. There's also two UN agencies have been doing the same work. How long will you be doing this for?
So we have, because of this incredible results that this arrangement shows, and there was a decision to extend it for one more year, so we will be working for one more year, but there is a chance that, because you know it's a professional services, you know, procurement, it is a professional service, can be outsourced. And you know, it's been, there is a discussion ongoing in Ukraine, so as of now we're staying for one more year.
I mean, is there a recognition among Ukrainians of I mean, is it publicly known, this... I mean, it's a triumph, right? It's amazing what you've achieved. Is this... I mean, do people know? Does everyone know this has happened?
They do know.
Yeah?
They do know that. And that, you know, for me, being a Ukrainian, it's very dear to my heart that my company is doing that for my people. So it's really amazing to feel that.
We're going to come back to you. Fergus? I've heard, I don't know if this is true or not, but I was told that this is the first time in Crown Agents' history that they had to hire a kind of, organise some form of PR campaign. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's a really interesting lesson for us, because I think Tanya is kind of glossing over, in some respects, the huge amounts of courage that she has shown, and our team on the ground, who have obviously lent into this challenge. There have been flash mobs materialized out of nowhere outside our offices, very specific erroneous articles in a structured way. Obviously, when you're leaning into corruption, people are going to be losers, and those losers are some pretty nefarious characters. So we work with an excellent organization called RAM on the ground, who have really helped us in terms of Facebook and social media to push back against some of the lies that have not only been peddled about us, but UNDP and UNICEF, the other two UN organisations, and the three of us who have been working on this procurement challenge.
I mean, it's a slightly odd situation for you to find yourself in, that your client was the government, and yet you had people in the government complaining about what you were doing. It's a sort of slightly, yeah, I mean, that's, it must be quite hard to get your head around what's going on, right?
Yes and no, because obviously if there's corruption on an endemic scale, then you're going to find people who are doing well, thank you very much, yeah, in different places. I mean, I think what was unique, and as both Henry and Tanya talked about, is that you had this push from the bottom, this kind of civil society movement that was focused on an anti-corruption background. You then had this courageous minister, Minister Suprone, who was going to really be at the forefront of this, and she's appeared on Hard Talk herself and has been really kind of out there. And then you had the Prime Minister as well, who I was at a function with him with about 80 other health professionals, civil society activists, the cameras there, and he basically said there are people pushing to go back to the old corrupt practices, and or there are populists, and I'm up for fighting against them both. I mean, he really put his own mandate and character on the line to say these are health wins for the people of Ukraine, and all these savings have been ploughed back into more stents to go from 7,000 to 25,000 in the country in over 2 years, and the first time, as Tanya said, that everyone who needed a stent in the country got one. So it's really visible, and that's the powerful thing.
I mean, it's interesting, because it's actually kind of a... Sorry about the microphone. It's a natural experiment that I can't use a microphone, but a natural experiment in that the first year after the revolution, the health minister was a revolutionary.
Yes.
And he essentially tried to do everything himself, and achieved almost nothing.
Yeah, Musa, was it?
Yeah, yeah. Mr. Musa. He, you know, he was a nice guy and all that.
Musa was acting, and then Kvitashvili.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Kvitashvili, yeah. Yeah. And then Suprone comes, and her approach, yeah, is much more... She really got involved in what you might, from the perspective of someone standing on a barricade.
She's actually American. I mean, yeah, Chicago trained, isn't she?
But you might consider to be boring technocratic details of corruption. Mm. But actually, this appears to be how you defeat corruption, is by engaging in the really difficult processes.
Yes.
Is this a lesson which is more applicable? Is this everywhere you come across this kind of... This is how, essentially, if you want to defeat corruption, this is how you do it?
Well, I think, you know, the kind of anti-corruption narrative is absolutely everywhere. I haven't seen an African leader or a manifesto not talk about corruption, because everyone feels it, so it's an obvious thing to stand on. I think it was unique, this confluence of civil society and the top cover, and then actually having the courage to bring in international organisations, because there's obviously a counter-narrative there that says, well, shouldn't this be Ukrainians doing it for themselves? And to pick up on Tanya's point, you know, we don't want to be there long term. The idea is to build capacity to get to a point where the Ukrainians have their own national procurement agency that is set up on internationally accepted procurement procedures, and then they can crack on and there's no turning back. But you don't get all of those pieces in place in lots of the other countries in which we work.
So, Tanya, how this process of if after you're there, what does Ukraine need to be able to not go back to how things were? Because, I mean, you know, some of the prices before were insanely expensive. I mean, I understand from the research by the Anti-Corruption Action Centre that, you know, they were overpaying for antiretrovirus by sort of 300%. It was incredible. I mean, you know, for a country with a really serious HIV problem, it was an insane situation.
So, as Fergus says, that Crown Agents is not there forever. So, but I think that everybody understands that everything that we achieved should be kept. So, and once we did that correctly, so there is no way back. And for us, what is the most important is that everything that we achieved and all experiences that we gained working in Ukraine and dealing with these hard issues, that they have to be kept and developed. So the most important thing for us is that those who will come after us or will take over after us, they have to do the same quality job. They have to be professionals and they have to be able to operate in the way we were operating. So they have to share the same principle, they have to have the same capacity, they have to have the same anti-corruption strategies all that time. And we are happy to transfer that experience to the staff of the Ministry of Health. So basically we are working with them on a daily basis. So they learn as they go. They learn as they work with us. Because even in the everyday exchange, we show them how that can be done and how that should be done. So my understanding that there's definitely no way back, because once you've seen the results, so you can't, you know, use old practices to go back to old black times. But they have to learn a lot to perform like us. So, but we will be definitely helping them and supporting them with that.
Henry Tanya is a terrible optimist.
Well, no, I mean, I wouldn't keep it. I wouldn't know if I first went to Ukraine 27 years ago, and I've been going back every year since then. So if I wasn't optimistic about the country, I wouldn't keep on going back. It is an extraordinary country with extraordinary potential, but sort of balanced, almost unconsciously. I think right from the start I understood it was a country which was sort of balanced so precariously between East and West. And I'd come back to England and say, look, you know, Ukraine's a really important country. And people would say, well, where's that? You know, part of Russia, isn't it, or something. And after Maidan, I could say, well, I told you so. I was prescient, even though I didn't quite understand it at the time. So I am, what I like doing, when I first went there, was mainly just technical operating and driving out to Kiev with lots of second-hand operating equipment. That's all. I didn't do that now, so it's not necessary. So what my real interest now is lecturing to medical students and young doctors. But it's very easy to sort of stand on a high horse, and I'll be lecturing in Kiev next week on the subject of medicine and money. So it's, you know, but doctors need to earn a living, and how you could actually pay doctors more is difficult, because all the problems of people don't pay tax and everything else. And there are too many hospitals, and there are too many doctors. It's terribly disorganized. And the huge Soviet-style hospitals, thousands of beds, which doesn't mean very much, but it needs fairly radical surgery to the actual infrastructure.
I mean, you've had this, you know, this kind of very targeted intervention by Crown Agents and the two UN agencies at this sort of central procurement level with these astonishing savings. You were describing, in a sort of micro level.
Well, it's all ground level.
Yeah, within hospitals, yeah. But a similar structure in that you have the people at the very top who are creaming off a lot of money, the people at the bottom are having to make up that shortfall by taking it off patients.
Yeah.
Could you see a way that this kind of model could be rolled out at a more micro level?
The short answer is no, I can't. But I mean, what you need is more transparency. But I mean, in England, most people are treated on the NHS, which I'm a passionate believer in. We have a hybrid system. You can go and do private work in your own time, but it's transparent. If you could somehow have a system whereby it could be seen how much extra money doctors were making, I mean, maybe it's impossible. It might help a little bit in some ways, but then that'd be very difficult to enforce. I mean, what bothers me is patients. Maybe on Ukrainian social media there's a sort of market exchange information and people can work out how much they should be paying, so to speak. But it seems to me it's very, very... patients are horribly exploited, just as they were in terms of drug procurement.
So I suppose the issue, Fergus, is that there's... I mean, this has... This one achievement, you know, is one of the great achievements of the Ukrainian Revolution in terms of the, you know, from a perspective of making things better for ordinary Ukrainians. But how is it possible to build on this and go somewhere, take this lesson further? And I mean, does Crown Agents have experience from, you know, the other countries? I mean, how many countries does Crown Agents? Dozens?
Yeah, well, overall, we've got a footprint of over 100 countries, but with 20 international offices. I mean, just to pick up on the point, I'm incredibly optimistic about Ukraine as well, and I agree it's an absolutely vital country in the geopolitics of Europe going on at the moment. We've been knocking on the door to use these skills in other ministries, and we haven't got through to other ministries. So I think that's kind of interesting in itself, in that it was even Minister Supran saying, we're going to do it here, but obviously the non-sensitive stuff, there's a lot of procurement that goes on through the Ministry of Defence and Education and all these areas, but we haven't been able to even break through and say, we're here to do something similar, to train your people up to make sure that this success story here goes wider. That's been hard enough.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, in lots of other, particularly African countries we work in, lots of different things, but I mean, you use the word transparency, it's shining the light in on these very dark practices where someone is making an awful lot of money. Now, kind of e-procurement is quite a buzzword at the moment, and there are aspects of that which is very positive, but that's not a magic bullet. You need greater transparency, full stop, there's a role for investigative journalists being able to say what they say in a really powerful way. Great agencies like Transparency International. We do other work. We do work for the Ghanaian government where we do value for money audits. So any large procurements that they're doing, they use an independent external organisation like us to say, yes, we've looked at your methodology and that is the greatest value for money you're getting for the Ghanaian taxpayer. And through that, we've saved the Ghanaian government $1 billion over the last 15 years of their procurements, anything from large hospitals to kind of motorways as well. But again, there's going to be losers in that. And so you've got to have people who are going to back an organisation coming in to do that work. So there is no magic bullet. There's a lot of different elements. And I suppose the other concern is you can go so far and then think job done. And then it all kind of filters away to nothing. So how do you ensure that there are mechanisms in place that the old bad practices don't come back?
In Ukraine had a previous revolution. I remember the party at the end of 2004 when the good guys won was one of the best parties I've ever been at. And then it was a bit of a disappointment.
It was a huge disappointment.
As it turned out.
It's always a major understatement.
A massive, catastrophic disappointment. and almost undescribably bad.
But it was a great party.
Yeah, okay. Wow, was it a good party. So I suppose the issue, Tanya, is after, I mean, there are presidential elections this year, parliamentary elections later this year. How do you consolidate the gains that you've made and make sure that this becomes the new normal? Because, I mean, it's brilliant that you're so positive about that and so optimistic about that, but I'm a little bit sort of once, twice bitten, twice shy, or whatever it was Bross said last week, that that issue that we've been here before, we had a revolution in Ukraine before, and everything that everyone thought they'd achieved failed. So how do you make sure that this becomes embedded and established as practice?
So I survived both revolutions. I was very active the first one. I was among the most active the first one. And I was just graduated from university and I was all there. So the second one, I was very critical.
Critical of
of everything. I was there, but I was critical. So the first revolution was... The revolution period was extremely disappointing for me. It was almost a personal tragedy for me because I was really expecting a lot of changes after the first revolution. So, but I have to say, probably I'm getting older and getting wiser, but I think that there is a huge difference between these two revolutions. Because after the first one, we were all believers that there is a good government that will come and they will do the job. And we were the ones who were not controlling enough our government. And we were not controlling enough our president, and that's why the previous president happened. So I think that what is important in this revolution shows how strong Ukrainian society is. And you, Oliver, know exactly what it is. I mean, in Ukraine now, so... It won't. The situation of the 2013-14 will never repeat because the civil society and the way Ukrainian society is structured, is organized now, will not allow that to happen again. Again, just to repeat what I've said, all our achievements, they are visible and they are touchable, and you can see them and you can get access to them. So once Ukrainian citizens try that, they will not allow to go back. So my my citizen, I'm my insurance against any negative pushbacks and changes. So I really rely on my people. So I don't think that there will be huge, pushback or whatever after the elections, and the presidential elections and the parliamentary elections in autumn. So again, I strongly believe in this. In Ukrainian citizens, in Ukrainian society. So I do expect that there will be only movement forward.
Are you also optimistic?
Well, it's great to hear that from the Ukrainian. I mean, I think one of the key things that Crown Agency is also involved in is training and professional development works. So we've trained over 60,000 mainly African senior civil servants over the last 50 years. In everything from public financial management to customs revenue reform. Women in leadership is now a massive course, which is fantastic. And so it's that issue about a kind of positive reforming top of society, not getting too far out from everyone else and bringing the middle managers and the civil servants kind of with you. Now, that's what we're obviously trying to do in Ukraine, and we're hoping to seed our skills into the National Procurement Agency. But the more you can do that, and the more you can kind of raise all ships in terms of people's knowledge and understanding of what good looks like, then I am optimistic that you aren't going to get pulled back to the dark dirt.
Is there a country that you can say that has been through what Ukraine went through with these insiders, both in and outside of administration, stealing budget money at the cost of society in general, and that have managed to get over that and get past that? Is there one of the countries where you work where you could say that is a place where, you know, they've got past corruption and now they're in a better place?
Well, I'm terrified to name countries, as that gives them the kiss of death. they're going to go backwards. But I think, I mean, certainly, I would say Ghana at the moment in West Africa is a success story generally, politically, in terms of levels of good governance. There's an interesting narrative from the president there about Ghana beyond aid and what that means, which is really good. I mean, there are other countries that we've worked in, so Angola, where Crown agents basically run the customs for 12 years there, and with significant savings of the scale that's been talked about. Unfortunately, that one has gone backwards in quite a significant way. So it's a constant it's a constant push, but you know, you do feel that the curve of positivity is going in the right direction, but you just get some challenges, and particularly sub-Saharan Africa.
So these events, these kleptoscope events, grew out of events we had a bit of a break at the moment called the kleptocracy tours, when we used to have a bus tour around West London and point out properties that belonged to, you know, Nigerian governors, daughter of the Angolan president, and so on. You know, people who maybe had more money than could be rationally explained, and who had bought very luxury properties, a way of trying to demonstrate the role of London in particular, and the West in general, in enabling the kind of theft that Tanya's been talking about.
You ought to sort of lobby Sadi Khan to have sort of clerks of shame.
Yes. Along
with
blue belt.
That is such a good idea.
But Tanya, what would you like from, I suppose, since so much of the money ends up in Britain, what would you like from, apparently, what would you like from Britain? What would be helpful to help, you know, build on the success, move on, because it's nice to look at practical actions. You know, what are the kind of things that Ukraine needs to help move ahead?
Well, there is a couple of things that are, first of all, you know, there is a difference between procurement officer and a doctor. But there is one thing that really unites us, and that is that we are showing the difference. You know, Dr. Marsh is very popular in my office. I mean, really. And I have 5 books in my bag to be signed. Otherwise, otherwise they said that they will not let me in. But, you know, everybody accepts that this doctor is, he's not just criticizing, he's showing a different approach to things. He's showing a totally different quality of work. The same Crown agents, British company, we are showing difference. We are offering professional services that nobody else can offer. So Ukraine is a country that is willing to accept unique experiences that nobody else has. And some of this experience sits here in the United Kingdom. So we are ready to observe that. So please bring more doctors.
Well, it has its downside. I was lecturing a while ago there, and one of my colleagues said, but you're far too easy to understand.
Absolutely.
And they won't respect you if they can understand what you're saying. You must make, this is their years of Marxism. If you think of a country which has been sort of marinated in 70 years of Marxism, Leninism, which was complete gibberish, it is not good for your intellect. You think that being comprehensible is a sign of, you know, wit and wisdom and everything else, and certainly your power.
Yeah.
But so trying to actually give medical lectures in the sort of European American way, in a clear, concise way, is a new thing for them. If you look at their textbooks, not that I can read Russian, but I can understand a bit of it. I mean, they're terrible. You know, they're so bad. But they have all the internet now. That's a fantastic thing. I mean, I'm lecturing next week about evidence-based medicine. It's all there on the internet, and these fantastic websites. I don't think that, you know, you probably all know the Cochrane collaboration,
which is a fantastic thing, a British invention. I don't think Ukraine subscribes to that. You have to pay for that. I'm not quite sure, but that would be a very good thing to do in Ukraine. So the doctors then have access to all the best evidence-based analysis there is.
Any billionaires in the room? They could pay for that, please. Okay, so that would be good. And what do you think Ukraine could teach Britain in terms of maybe mobilising people that we could stop accepting all the money that's been stolen from your hospitals and invested in our... you know, how do we mobilise British people to achieve...
By writing very good books like yours.
Well, obviously, I'm buying them.
sorry.
But you know, advice from, you know, from having succeeded in this, we haven't yet succeeded in driving this money out of London. What you know, could we learn from what you guys have achieved?
Just be brave. So, but honestly, I have to say that UK is doing really a lot helping Ukraine, I think that recent initiative about the opening the information about the assets. That was really. I mean, I think that for UK it was really a brave step. So, I think that there is. You probably can do more.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not me to advise you how to do that.
I think. I mean, we've been. You know, people from Britain have been advising Ukraine.
But honestly, UK is really helping Ukraine a lot, especially when it comes to political support, and we do appreciate that. I mean, there is a massive support to Ukraine that comes from British politicians. So probably you can do more in this anti-money laundering stuff, but that's your government that has to decide.
So Tanya's being far too diplomatic here, Fergus.
I graduated from the diplomatic academy. So.
Do you think there are, from a program like this, do you think there are lessons that could be applied in this country?
Well,
I mean, not specifically in procurement necessarily,
no, exactly.
But in terms of time in mobilising support behind improvement.
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue, and again, there have been some small steps in the last couple of years about being scrutinising more these inflows of money and making them not stick as they do, and asking questions about, you know, your great tour, and so is it Mayfair, the X amount of the properties there, we just don't know who owns them, and the kind of concept of shell companies is vast. I think there is also an increasing narrative about concerns about inequality writ large, and you know, I'm always a great fan, it always gets lots of naysayers, but the Oxfam report that points out that 27 people own half of the wealth of the world. I mean, that's quite incredible. Great philanthropists leaning into that, and obviously Gates and everything else, but the more we can show and say how that unbalances society, and obviously support political parties or whomever, or use social media to articulate our voices more, that can only be a positive thing.
Okay, I'm going to, before I give you guys the options to ask some questions, I just want to give a shout out to some great Ukrainian activist groups, particularly the one called Nashi Hroshi, Our Money, which is very good, look it up online, and the Anti-Corruption Action Centre. They've been doing a lot of the original groundbreaking research into medical corruption in Ukraine, when actually reporting on corruption in Ukraine was liable to have you killed, was done by these extraordinary, brave activists, Sasha Ustinova, who's currently in America, and Daria Kalinyuk and Vitaly Shabunin. So please check them out. Now, I'm hoping that some people might have some questions, because I think these guys are extraordinary. Ewan, who is traditionally our first questioner.
Wait for the mic. You can hold it as close as it's hygienic.
Thank you very much, all. Ewan Grant, I'm the former UK customs intelligence analyst for the ex-Soviet Union. I worked in immediate post-Orange Revolution and immediate pre- and post-Maidan European Commission programs, mainly with the border guards, also to a certain extent with the SBU and the customs. I'm an owner of Oliver's book. The book justifies itself on the index alone, and that's before you get started on the very valuable text. My question, two questions, one, both essentially about sustainability of the programme. Are there, given that Ukraine is a large country with considerable regional fiefdoms. Are there any plans perhaps to work with other strong friends of Ukraine, like the Poles, whom Dr. Marshak mentioned that their pro bono work, on measuring continued effectiveness across the board, perhaps mainly in Western and far Western Ukraine, on deliverables, quality, cost, and so on? And secondly, for further development in other ministries and therefore other issues, you mentioned, Mr. Drake, the defence ministry. Now, of course, getting into that, you're going to be looking at some very, very sensitive issues, including issues which can very much help Western countries. What would you like to say about preparation for that? Are you getting support of international organizations, UN and particularly EU member states and EC, on the massive cascade effects of that? In other words, joined up project work with others. Thank you.
There's a lot to unpack there.
Yes. So shall I start with the second one?
Yeah.
I mean, we are very aware that obviously, as a UK-based organisation, there are elements of the procurement chain in the Ministry of Defence we are not going to be able to touch in any way, and obviously that's totally understandable.
That's the first battle.
Well,
if you're aware of that.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. However, things like food being procured, bandages, I mean, really basic things, that again, you can break out from three or four, perhaps even less in that environment, establish procurement agencies and do what we did in health by going over to 90 different companies across 17 different countries. I am convinced that there will be the similar scale of savings and impact that we will be able to bring into that area. Yes, as you can expect, we're having conversations with the embassy, we're having conversations with the EU as well, but these are, I would say, health was a beachhead. To get into Ministry of Defence would be fabulous, because we feel that would be such a positive impact on the country, but it's going to be a very long conversation.
Tony, with regard to the first question, maybe working with the Poles or whatever, is there a degree of sensitivity about being a foreign company or working with foreign partners, or are people very accepting of assistance if it's sort of well-intentioned?
I can talk only about this healthcare procurements,
yeah.
But Ukraine is very open to cooperating with an international
partner,
so it's fabulous to work.
Yeah, good. All right. Where's our microphone? There. Let's go all the way to the back. It's that extremely distinguished gentleman at the back who I used to work with in Moscow.
Oh, I'm also an owner of Ola's book. You talked about the pitifully low wages for doctors. Do you have does anyone on the panel have a sense of, if it's $200 currently, what would be a sort of level which you think would extinguish, if not all of it, but a significant part, and how much money would be needed? The state would need to fund that, and could some of the savings sort of filter back into the system that way?
That's a very interesting question.
I mean, in terms of what is quite complicated, first of all, doctors are often incredibly greedy, you know, so even if you paid them more, they'd still go on ripping off the patients. So it depends on a new generation of more ideas. So it's always a problem in medicine. Is it a vocation or is it a business? And where you are on that spectrum is influenced by all sorts of things. But a lot of doctors still are essentially do it for a vocation, and one hopes that the new generation of Ukrainian doctors be more on the Ukrainian side, more on the vocational side of the spectrum than the business side of the spectrum. I don't know what the figures are like, but I'm pretty sure there are too many hospitals and too many doctors. But even as in this country, it's incredibly difficult to merge hospitals and rationalise things in that way. But in theory, you probably could finance better pay for doctors by having rather fewer doctors. I don't know the situation in Kiev now, but when I first went there, I was told there were 300 neurosurgeons in Kiev, or doctors who called themselves neurosurgeons. and the population of Kiev and the area was about 3 or 4 million. My hospital in London, with a catchment area of 2.5 million, at that point had 4 neurosurgeons. I mean, then how you define what's a doctor, what's a nurse, things like that is very difficult. And another thing we haven't touched upon is the problem of nursing, which is a huge problem. And my specialty, post-operative care, because they don't get paid that much by the families and patients. And when I've had serious problems when I've been operating or helping, it's usually not been the actual technicalities of the operating, but the backup, the post-operative care. And that's a huge problem. I don't know whether many... I work in other impoverished countries, mainly in Nepal, and the problem there is you train people up, they all leave. And I don't know whether there's an exodus of doctors and nurses in Ukraine or not. The language might be a barrier to that, to some extent. There are more Ethiopian doctors in America than in Ethiopia, I read.
That is an interesting question about the culture of corruption. Who is, as it were, initiating the bribe? Is it the patient who just... this is expected, or the doctor who's demanding it, and how do you break that culturally embedded practice?
That will be a very subjective answer. Yeah. That yeah. will be me being a Ukrainian citizen. I think it's both.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, it is a mindset that was cultivated in us for many, many years. So doctor is expecting, and I'm also expecting to do that.
Yeah.
So it's just like, you know, moving.
Because that is difficult, because if you were suddenly to start paying Ukrainian doctors 4,000 euros a month, there's no reason why they wouldn't necessarily say, well, I'll still just have some more money.
Well, then you have to be terribly transparent in some way, don't you?
Yeah. But just one comment. Ukraine is going through the healthcare reform. We are now more or less through the primary healthcare reform. So things are improving, and money goes after the patients, etc., etc. Dr. Marsh is talking about very narrow health.
Yeah, I mean, neurosurgery is a terribly small thing.
Yes.
And if you have limited money to spend on healthcare, don't spend it on neurosurgery. My colleague in Nepal said this when he became the Minister of Health. He said he reckoned he saved far more lives by making motorcycle helmets compulsory than he ever would have saved as a neurosurgeon.
Okay. Yes, how about right over there at the back?
Hi, I'm Amra Wilson. I work for HelpPro, which is a British NGO which works in the former communist countries.
Did you say HelpPROM?
HelpPROM.
Okay.
Tiny shoestring NGO, mainly funded with EC grants, which we will no longer be able to apply for after the next few months, presumably. So in Ukraine, we've been working to mobilise parent organisations, parents of children with disabilities, to help them to fight the system of putting children in institutions, help them develop family care. So I've been very interested in health reforms, and I've been very, very lucky to meet Minister Suprun on several occasions, and that's been fantastic to watch the work that she's managed to spear. I've got a couple of questions. I'm very interested in this whole issue of sustainability. I know that Ilana Suprun made decisions to work on procurement because she didn't know how long she'd last in post. And with the elections coming up, there's a strong chance that she could not be in the post. I'm very interested in what you said, Tanya, about how because people can feel and see the reforms, they will not allow things to go backwards. But I've got a question here, which is, where is the media on this? Because my understanding is that we cannot see an independent media in Ukraine. So what are they saying about this work in the reforms, and what role will they play in the election? This is the frontline club, you know, the media is critical here. And the second kind of sub-question is that Poroshenko, the current president, is doing very badly on the polls at the moment, and the possible successor is indeed the lady with the braid, Tymoshenko, who we all remember from the law from before Maidan, and I understand, and I can't confirm this, but I understand that she has described the health reforms as genocide for the people of Ukraine. So if she comes back into post, you know, what's going to happen? So a couple of questions.
Yeah. I mean, I think it might be unfair to ask you to comment specifically on Yulia Vladimirovna. But on the sustainability of the healthcare reform, considering the change of president, that is quite an important topic.
Well, Ukraine is a parliamentary presidential republic. So in our case, the parliament is the one who decides about the composition of the government. So I do expect that there will be changes after the election of the president, but I do expect more changes in autumn when we will have parliamentary elections. I'm not so optimistic about the results of the poll about the lady. So we shall see. Honestly, in Ukraine, you can never predict who will be the winner. So it's a democratic election.
Will she oppose the reforms?
I don't think so, because she recently used our results. So, again, if something is showing a positive impact, so Ukrainian politicians will not oppose that. They will build on that, rather. That's my
question. And the media?
Yes, about the media. In the beginning, I think that we have to accept that was our mistake, that we were not talking. So we, Crown Agents, the essence of the company is that we were always working for the government, holding their hands, but we were never active speakers. So we never had any proactive campaigns about us. We never were talking about our results ourselves. We were expecting that the government will take the result that we showed, and that's their results. So, and in Ukraine, if you are not speaking about yourself, somebody else will immediately start speaking about you. And that who is speaking instead of you will be point of reference for media. And that's what happened with us. So now the situation is different. So now we are the primary point of contact for the majority of the mass, or the central mass media that are writing about that. And what is a good thing is that we managed to train certain, not to train, but to, yes, probably train certain quantity of the journalists. At least they understand the concept of procurement. They understand what we are doing. And if they understand, they come and become more professionals. So that's life. Thank you.
I mean, there is, the political change, presumably, is something which Crown Agents comes across in other countries when you're trying to do something and then there's a change at the top. Does it often impact what you're doing?
I mean, it's interesting as to where the work is owned by. So if it's something that is seen as an inherent good for the whole country, then whoever is going to come into power is going to own that and champion it going forward, and hopefully that's the case that we've got in Ukraine. Our role, obviously, as a not-for-profit international development company, isn't to get involved in the kind of political bows and arrows there. What we have been involved in, though, is the kind of bedrock legislation you have to put in place if you want to get decent procurement procedures that are accepted across government, establish things like national procurement agencies, and put training in place as well. So that's the kind of behind-the-scenes role that we feel that we can play, and we do it generally quietly, because it's the government to own the reform going forward.
But there's a line in Blackadder when Hugh Laurie says, "I wouldn't like to blow my own trumpet," and Rowan Atkinson says, "Well, you could at least have let us know you had a trumpet." I feel that Crown Agents, you've been hiding your light under quite a lot of bushels.
Yes.
You know, isn't it? I mean, I'm wondering, I mean, obviously I'm a journalist, so I think the solution always involves more journalism, but a bit more.
Apparently, have you got a book out?
Available in another bookshop. But I'm just wondering, I mean, you know, it is, it, you know, I was wondering whether this lesson of actually having to engage is something you will now take more broadly.
I think it's very true, and to a certain extent, my previous role was at Save the Children, who were very good at the kind of media side of things, but in general. I think that there is a challenge for us to be able to convey the role that Crown Agents does. And I think in certain environments, if you're going head on in an anti-corruption drive, there isn't anything better than having a really capable local office with incredible leaders like Tanya, who just ooze integrity, but then also using the levers you have available to you. So you've got to be able to respond quickly in Ukrainian on Facebook, on Instagram, to whatever is the tweet that's trying to take you down at the knees. And actually that's quite a small investment for the level of impact that you're getting in your program, and whether we should be more systemically doing that when we deploy into some of these countries is a really good question.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. Yes, there's a gentleman behind you.
Hi, my name is James, formerly of Transparency International's Health Programme and formerly of Crown Agents as well. So this is a story I've been following keenly ever since the Ukrainian government called their own health ministry corrupt. And that sort of gets to the heart of my question and sort of touching it in the previous answers, and that's political will. There's no doubt in my mind that the biggest barrier to universal health coverage across the world is corruption. Yet, it's nowhere near the top of the global health agenda. How can we push that up there? How can we use all of the tools available to us, including development consultancy firms and civil society, the media, etc., to put pressure on government who are unwilling to change the status quo because it's profitable for them? Because ultimately, it's going to be the poorest, most marginalised that lose out when it comes to corruption in health systems. The richest will simply purchase those drugs elsewhere. They will pay the bribes. But it undermines any sort of progress we have. The Kenyan health system's health budget execution rate is less than 50%. Now, not all of that money has been lost to corruption. A lot of it's just 50. Bad budget. So it's 48%.
So 52% goes missing.
Not goes missing. I guess returned to central government because their budgeting support, right, because of the public financial management systems are bad. But also there is an element of corruption there as well. Now, that is a country that isn't spending enough money on its health system to provide a basic level of essential medicine for everybody in the country, and they can't even spend half of that.
Yeah.
So how can we make sure that corruption, improved governance, improved public financial management and health systems is at the top of the global health agenda?
Henry, you've been quite good at telling compelling stories about medicine, you know, and making sure, making people, you know, understand quite complicated issues in quite straightforward stories. How would you, you know, I'm assuming now...
Well, I think that another short answer is it's freedom of the press, isn't it? Free media. Isn't that the most effective weapon? Well, you can't expect corrupt people to de-corrupt themselves, you know? So there has to be pressure from below, as Tanya was saying. It's been so important in Ukraine. If you don't have free press, you'll get nowhere. And that, of course, depends on the rule of law. And so many of these countries are where justice is who's paid the judge the biggest bribe or got the most political vote. So in a sense, I'd say you improve healthcare by improving civil society rather than actually directly doing anything to the healthcare system itself. And the free press is the first thing. Obviously, I'm preaching to the converted. And second is the rule of law. And I think money is better spent in many ways doing that than trying to save lots of appealing poor little children.
That's a tough... it's a tough argument to make, though.
Yeah, right? It's a very tough argument to make. It's a rather... It's an unsentimental argument to make.
You know, working on the systems, improving the systems and letting everything else take care of itself, is that, you know, do you think that's a fair lesson, that this is how you achieve actual change in terms of healthcare? I don't know, it's a tough argument to make. Yeah, it's tough, I'm not going to go there. Yes, there's a lady at the front.
I'd actually just like to respond in some way to that question, if I may.
You may.
My name's Elizabeth Zani, I'm an epidemiologist and I work on various politics of global health. And I think that one thing, and I also work particularly on substandard and falsified medicines, so I'm coming for you guys afterwards. But I think that one of the issues is, why is corruption not very high on the global health agenda? If we look currently at who's setting the global health agenda, essentially you've got two broad people setting that agenda, or two broad groups setting that agenda. One is Bill Gates,
right,
who has an extraordinary influence on the whole of the global health agenda, not least because he's funding currently about 17% of the WHO's budget, and member states only fund 22% through core funding. So, yeah.
Where does the 60?
So it comes from special programs. So right. the UK will give you this for mental health, and the Danes will give you that for blindness, okay, and etc. But the other thing is that the WHO, which is the other big voice, yeah, in setting the agenda, is essentially owned by its shareholders, the member states.
Yeah.
And since a very large number of those are captured by exactly the corrupt mechanisms you're talking about, they're not going to be the ones who are banging drums for it in any practical way, although, as you say, it's always top of the metropolitan agenda.
So we need to get Bill Gates on board.
Yes, but Bill Gates does. He thinks, I mean, with respect to his extraordinary intellect and his respect for data, which is great, but he does. He is the technocrat to end all technocrats, and he doesn't do messy human stuff.
Okay.
And he particularly doesn't do politics, and corruption is messy human incentives, economics, and you can't fix it with an app.
No. Interesting. Okay, sounds like you two, well, you guys want to talk about it. Here's a gentleman who's behind you there.
When the process of changing the procurement methodology was underway and you were under attack, what justification were the attackers using? Because they could hardly say, you're stopping me from being corrupt. As so what reasons did they give? And a secondary question, was there an element of danger in all of this as well? Because you were basically taking money away from the local mafia.
The craziest comment I ever get about myself is that I was the leader of Anglo-Saxon mafia in Ukraine.
Anglo-Saxon mafia.
That I'm trying.
You're related to the Cray twins. Yes.
So that was probably the craziest stuff. So that's stupid. But they were saying that Crown Agents is introducing the standards that will not allow Ukrainian manufacturers to bid.
So you are reducing the standards. You are excluding Ukrainian manufacturers.
All kinds of stuff. But again, so I think that the first attack started when they said that our procurement procedures will not allow Ukrainian manufacturers to bid.
Right.
But then suddenly three of them won our contract. That stopped. So it came one after another that our procedures are, well, they're talking English.
Yeah.
We do not understand. So, okay, if you want to go global, learn English. That's again, we killed that. The second one was that we are not allowing Ukrainian bidders to bid. Again, when we started showing the results, we killed that comment, etc., etc. So all sorts of, from very stupid to very smart comments that were coming, saying that we are actually bringing international corruption instead of national corruption. So
there wasn't there an issue when quite a lot of the farmers, the medicines were held up at customs because there was a debate about whether you had to pay tax on them or something?
No, that was one particular company.
Yeah.
Who had their agenda.
Yeah.
They wanted that process to be stopped.
Yeah.
And they were doing all sorts of tricks. But in fact, that was sorted out.
Yeah, but I mean, it shows again that there was it's a very complicated form.
It is a very complicated. I have to say that the campaign was well prepared. It was not like it sported things. So it was all structured and prepared, and that was done very systematically.
And I mean, it was also combined with a big anti-vaccination campaign as well.
The Crown Agents is not doing vaccines in Ukraine. Yeah, but there is a massive anti-vaccination campaign.
Which was also, I mean, it was UNICEF were doing.
UNICEF was doing it.
And the issue of personal safety?
We never received personal threats. In this case, Ukraine is a normal country.
Yes.
I mean, mostly they were using mass media in attacking us. But I have to say, there was not a single personal attack.
And there were also members of parliament attacking you a lot?
Members of the parliament, yes. In Ukraine, well, probably that's true for all other countries, if they are losing the public presence or presence in the mass media, they immediately have to create a scandal. Mm. So they create a scandal, they are all newspapers. Again, they were using absence of information or misunderstandings, or they have no idea how procurement works. So they figure out something, they create a scandal, they find a journalist who is just boosting that in a couple of newspapers, but as soon as you explain how it works, it goes down.
Okay.
It's just, it takes a lot of, I have to say that the first year it took probably 70% of my time just talking and explaining.
70%?
Yeah, but I'm not doing the procurement.
Yeah, and how about now? How much of your time is now talking?
Well, I'm now concentrating on business winning.
Business winning. Okay, so that's good. So you don't have to spend quite as much time explaining.
Well, as soon as you explain to the society how it works with the simple words, and as soon as they understand, then the heat goes down. you have to be very accurate and very simple in explaining what you're doing.
Okay, excellent. Yes, there is a lady at the front.
Thank you. I have your book.
There's no left behind.
I've read the first four chapters, and I'm I've learned so much.
Thank you.
And it's so scary and enlightening. What I was wondering about, since the NHS is being attacked here, and I'm Canadian, and we have a new Trump-like premier in the biggest province of Ontario who wants to privatize our health care, are you getting that kind of pressure from the outside? I mean, how much, if you have privatization, you won't, I mean, the government will have less and less say, and groups like yours won't be able to impact and work with the government as much. It'll be much more free market. I'm just wondering if you're getting that kind of pressure, since the UK is, and Canada, and most countries.
Well, there's, we are just starting building our NHS. So we just created it. So we're not talking about privatizing, etc. So in Ukraine, the private and state system is being developed in parallel. So, but I haven't heard, probably.
You haven't got to, yeah.
Well, there are increasing number. I didn't have figures on it. There's an increasing number of private hospitals in Ukraine. I was in Odessa recently, and it was a funny story. It was formerly a fruit machine factory, and then the Rada passed the law banning gambling machines. So the business said, what should we do? So it turns into a private hospital. It's like a factory. There's a rooms, a windowless. It's actually very well equipped and very luxurious, and they reckon they're going to make money from it. I think there are huge drawbacks to it. I mean, I think a sort of hybrid system as we have in this country is probably some sort of solution. But I'm not happy. Well, there are lots of problems in private practice if that dominates the system. Because, as I said, the fact of the matter is, it's quite clear in America, you know, if you pay hospitals and doctors piece rates, they do more and more work. I mean, the current analysis of America, which spends more per capita, twice as more than the European average per capita, about $8,000-$9,000 per capita per year. The European average is about $4,000 to $4,500. It's about 30% of that is probably wasted, not through overt corruption, but just some unnecessary investigations and unnecessary treatment. So it's a real threat, actually. So it's why it's really important that countries like Ukraine try to develop, you know, robust public health systems.
We've been rabbiting on for about an hour and a half, so I think we're going to stop now. But I've been really, really pleased that you've all been here. I was actually a little bit worried that people wouldn't want to hear a good story, because normally we tell some spine-tingling tales of woe and doom, and actually just turning up and saying, actually, you know what, here's some people have done something awesome. It's really good to see you all. Thank you. Please join me in thanking Tania and Fergus.
So this book.